Welcome to the podcast for the book, Deliberate Injustice, The Wrongful Conviction of Ken Wynemco. Written by author Bob Hennigy. Published and printed by ZG Serve, LLC. Copyright Deliberate Injustice, LLC. This podcast was produced by Connie Nesberry International, LLC. For more information, visit www.deliberateinjusticethebook.com.
Picture yourself sitting in a courtroom waiting to be found not guilty of a crime that you know you didn't commit. You trust that the police and your attorney are doing their jobs and the court system is working for true justice. Then you're convicted based on lies and withheld evidence. You're told you'll be in prison for decades. What would you do?
I never imagined, never thought something like this could happen in our country, where a person could be wrongfully convicted, and I never imagined that it would happen to me.
You just heard quotes from author Bob Hennigy and Ken Wynemco, the exoneree, respectively. This podcast is about the investigation and trial. We'll start with Bob providing more details.
The longest chapter in Deliberate Injustice is the one that covers the trial. We tried to take apart what the prosecution presented and what the defense really didn't present. Now, I'll give you an example. The investigation was botched in so many different angles. They received so many tips about individuals that had just been released. They received one tip on one individual that whose MO kind of matched this crime scene from three different individuals, including someone from a police department, and never followed up on it. This anonymous tip sat in the police department for over 2 months before they followed up on it. Now, if you present that to the jury, how badly botched this investigation was, including sitting on this tip for 2 months, and what made it more believable 2 months later?
How could they possibly convict him with no direct evidence?
Well, the most damaging evidence against him was the victim identification. Number one, throughout the investigation, the victim always claimed she never saw his face. The only time she saw any part of his face is when his mask was pulled up above his lips to take a drink. And
so how could she possibly pick him out of a lineup then?
Well, that's the problem. And when you have a lineup, there's a form called a show-up identification record. It's a record of the lineup, and everything that happens in that lineup is supposed to be recorded. Some very bothersome things that happen during this lineup identification. Number one, Kenny was put in a lineup with five others that all had mustaches, and Kenny never had a mustache. During a lineup, there is supposed to be a defense attorney representing Kenny. They had a stand-in defense attorney. And he was told that she never saw her attacker's face.
So did her attacker have a mustache?
No. He never had a mustache. So having five guys in there with mustaches made no sense. Plus, in the show-up identification record, they never made any mention that the other stand-ins had mustaches. She at first could not identify Kenny. She left the viewing room, privately conversed with representatives from the prosecutor's office and from the police, came back in, asked for a voice sample. They gave a voice sample. She couldn't identify Kenny from the voice sample. Now you're sitting here with someone that said she never saw his face. Everybody else has mustaches but Kenny. And then all of a sudden, she picked Kenny out of the lineup. It's rife with controversy. They didn't note that she left the viewing room in the middle of the lineup.
Why would you leave the room?
I don't know. I don't know if she was upset. She very well could be. But when the first thing she said is, I can't pick anybody out of the lineup. But to go privately in the middle of a lineup identification is just wrong. You don't privately converse with police and with prosecutors away from the defense attorney. And that's what they did.
I would think they would take her first reaction, that she couldn't identify anybody.
You would think so. But like I said, they had blinders on, and they were there to get Kenny convicted. And we'll get into a lot more detail as far as that goes. And I think that the defense attorney would have been prudent to try to discredit that as much as he could. And he had so many damaging facts that he could have applied in his cross-examination and the things that he, not only with the victim itself, but also with the police.
I'm trying to get straight in my mind how somebody could say their assailant was weighed 220 and was the 6'3" guy, huge guy, and then pick somebody way smaller out of a lineup. Why would the police even bring somebody smaller into a lineup?
And here's another problem. The police gave the description of the perpetrator on a sheet to the defense attorney that he was 5'11", 180. So they themselves changed it to fit to Kenny. This whole identification should have been torn apart by the defense attorney. And yet, like so many of the cross-examinations by the defense attorney, his cross-examination of the victim lasted less than 2 minutes. It was really ridiculous.
Are there more examples of how the defense attorney dropped the ball here?
The attorney was giving a weekend to prepare, and that didn't help. But throughout all of the transcripts and some of the things he said to Kenny and some of the things that he did to keep evidence away from Kenny, he didn't act as Kenny's legal representative. I think he believed that Kenny was guilty, and I think some of the things that he did, they came out in that. So, the bottom line, Kenny had a horrible defense, and that's one of the primary reasons that the cops were able to do the things that they did and the prosecutor was able to get away with the things that she did during trial. So,
was there other evidence found?
Well, one of the things that people were astonished was there was a ton of forensic evidence at the crime scene, none of them implicating Kenny. They did an ABO blood test on everything that they warranted. Kenny's blood type did not match any of the items that were tested. And there also were footprints found outside the room, a footprint and a cigarette butt, where they believed that the assailant was sitting looking through a window, either getting his nerve up or waiting for the right time or to make sure that she was home alone. Footprint casts were taken. They were not presented in evidence at the time of the trial. It was only years later, after they looked into it in 2003. Those footprints did not match Kenny's shoe size. Cigarette butts were found at the crime scene. Neither the wife or her husband nor Kenny smoked. The perpetrator did. She testified, and on numerous occasions, there were notes that the guy reeked from cigarette smoke. In this trial, I think the second thing that he should have done was promote the theory that there was another assailant, because it did happen. And if Kenny didn't do it, somebody else did it. And he never promoted that theory. Not once did he mention the fact that somebody else did the crime.
What else came up during the trial?
Well, one of the things that came up, Kenny's ex-girlfriend portrayed their relationship as abusive, and really, she was out to get him. There was no cross-examination whatsoever from the defense attorney. One of the items that the police hid from the defense was an answering machine. When they served a search warrant and ransacked Kenny's home, they took the answering machine. On the answering machine, it had many messages from the ex-girlfriend, how she's going to kill him, she's going to ruin him, she's going to make sure that he rues the day she met him. I mean, it was very, very damaging and could have been used to contradict her real reason for testifying. The police took this tape, hid it in another police file. Defense attorney and Kenny never knew where it went. And Kenny asked on several occasions, he asked the investigating officers when he was being interrogated, where's that tape? Don't worry about it. He was on the stand and talked about it. In fact, the prosecution asked him a question that, you said that your ex-girlfriend had threatened your life and threatened to ruin you, and do you have any proof of that? And Kenny responded, and this is in the court document. This is in the court trial transcript. Kenny responded that, yes, I had an answering tape at my home. The police took it, and nobody knows where it is. They hid it. You have someone under oath testifying that the police did something illegal by hiding exculpatory evidence. Now, Kenny was waiting for his lawyer to chime in and say, whoa, wait a minute, where is this? We need to produce it. Well,
yeah, you would think so.
The prosecutor just changed the subject. The judge himself, if he was looking for the truth, you know, this is, again, something illegal. He never questioned it. The defense attorney never questioned it. The prosecutor never questioned it. So again, it's part of the investigation with the blinders on, but none of that was pointed out. And those are the types of things that are listed as questions the defense didn't ask during that whole chapter called about the trial. So that's just one example. There are probably a dozen of them of things that he should have said besides just giving it the 1.5, 2 minute cross-examination that he did.
I'm thinking, too, from Kenny's perspective, he didn't deal with anything like this before, right? He's just sitting in the courtroom trusting that his attorney's doing a good job.
He was naive, and he thought the truth would come out. And even when he's sitting there and waiting for the defense attorney to ask the right questions, now he knows that he should have taken all kinds of different actions than the ones that he did. His whole trial is detailed in the longest chapter, really, of the book. It's an appalling account of how our justice system can actually fail. In truth, it was a total breakdown in the American judicial system. Everyone was to blame. The police, the prosecutor, Ken's defense attorney, even the judge. One of the worst things that happened in Ken's case was the fact that the defense attorney was only given a weekend to prepare. I mean, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And then the judge is responsible for that.
I know, we haven't even discussed the jailhouse snitch yet.
There's so much more to the case. It would take hours. You just have to read the book.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Connie.
Now I'd like to ask Ken some questions about the trial. Ken?
Before you were arrested, did you believe that this could ever happen to anyone, that they would be wrongfully convicted?
I did not, believe it or not. I had a hard time. I could never fathom that something like that would or could happen in our country. And, you know, I can remember when I was in grade school and high school, I went to Catholic school, you know, for 12 years, as I said. We were always told, hey, if you get in trouble, you have a problem, call a cop. And now, when I get the bigger picture, I don't know if I'd call a cop at all or not, or if I'd trust a cop.
Yeah, I would think you would hesitate now.
Sure. Absolutely. So that, to make a long story short, I never imagined, never thought something like this could happen in our country, where a person could be wrongfully convicted, and I never imagined that it would happen to me. But now I see what the real system is like.
Yeah. Why do you think you were the one that was arrested?
There's only one logical reason that I can think of, and I've had many years to think about why that is. And it goes back to about an incident that happened about 6 months before I got arrested. I was managing a pair of bowling centers in Macomb County, okay? And there was an evening where we had a family night. We had a packed house, mom and dad bringing their kids in to bowl. And there was an individual bowling by himself, a male, who was giving a hard time to the families on both sides of his lanes. And brought in two bowling bags with him. One had two bowling balls in it. The other one had cans of Miller Lite beer. It's illegal to bring in alcohol to someone who has a liquor license. I said, John, look, I don't want to argue with you. I can tell you already had too much to drink. I said, do yourself a favor, just leave and come back and see me tomorrow when you're straight. And he said, you can't throw me out. I said, well, you're wrong about that. I said, but just out of curiosity, you want to tell me why you think I can't throw you out? And he went in his pocket and he pulled out a badge. He showed me a police badge, Clinton Township Police. So I said, look, I don't know, number one, I don't know if that badge is real or not. I said, but if it is real, you being a cop should know better. You, more than anybody, should know better than to bring alcohol into a place that has a liquor license. I said, so it was time for you to go. Well, I went back to my office. About a half hour later, Terry, my counter, who's working the counter tonight, comes in my office and he says, Kenny, there's two cops out here. I want to talk to you. I said, send them in. So, they asked my name and... One cop said, I heard you had a little problem here a while ago. I said, I didn't have any problem. And he wanted to know what happened. So I explained to him, just like I told you right now, what happened. He says, Kenny, that guy, did he identify himself as a police officer? And again, just like I told you, I said, he showed me a badge, and I didn't know if it was real or not. But I'll tell you guys, just the same as I told him, if he is a cop, he should know better than to bring beer into a licensed business.
Right.
So, one guy was walking, one guy's talking to me, the other guy's looking around the office, and one cop said, is your liquor license up to date? I said, sure, it's up to date. He says, where's it at? I want to see it. He says, if you want to see the license, I'll pull it off the wall for you. I'll bring it down here and show it to you. So they stuck around for a little while longer than as they were walking out. One cop said, "Oh, we'll probably be seeing you 5 or 6 months down the road." I said, "Is that some kind of a threat? Are you threatening me?" He says, "No, I'm not. Why would I threaten you?" I said, "Well, then why'd you say what you said?" "Well, just, you know, I'll probably come stop in and see you." So that is the only logical reason why I think they came after me. Nothing else makes sense. And I was only doing my job and protecting the law, upholding the law.
After you were convicted, what did you think when you were sitting in the courtroom?
You know, I've said this many times. When the jury said, when I heard the words guilty, it's almost like somebody hit me with a stun gun. I was in a fog. I didn't know where I was at. You know, it's like time stopped. And I'm looking into, you know, straight ahead, and all I can see is fog. That's the best way I can describe it. And then, you know, I want to make it very clear, too, which is clearly stated in the book. Judge Schwartz gave me this attorney on a Friday afternoon, Kenny. Friday afternoon. And he told me that I'm going to take the attorney that he's going to give me that day, and if I don't like him, I can defend myself. And this is all a matter of public record. And I told him, I said, "Your Honor, I'm going to tell you the same thing that I told the police officers and the prosecutor. They are making a big mistake." I also told him that, you know, I don't know anything about that much about the law. And back then I didn't, because I was never in trouble before. Judge Schwartz told me, he said, "I don't care about that. And come Monday morning, we're going to start picking a jury. Now, this is a capital offense case, 15 counts of CSE-1. That's rape in the first degree. One count of armed robbery, one count of breaking and entering. This guy has a weekend to prepare. No attorney in their right mind anywhere could possibly prepare a defense over a weekend. You couldn't defend a client for drunk driving over the period of a weekend.
I can't imagine why the attorney would even take the case.
Because as I said, the reason he took it was because that's how he made his money.
Okay? But you don't even, he doesn't have time to get to know you. You don't have time to get to know him.
I mean, the game plan was set up.
Just to get somebody convicted.
I was the victim, yeah. Mm-hmm. That was it. If you look at all the players, the only person during my trial who did not commit any crime at all was me. And what happens to me? I get sent to prison for 40 to 60 years. Everybody else gets promoted.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. We would like to give you a 20% discount for ordering the book, Deliberate Injustice, The Wrongful Conviction of Ken Wynemco, at www.deliberateinjusticethebook.com. Use code POD20. Order today to learn more about wrongful convictions and how this can happen to anyone. Again, your discount code is POD20.